Hi, I'm Ronald Weaver from Santa Monica. You're listening to WGXC
Acra.
The views expressed by on-air volunteer hosts do not reflect the views of Wavefarm or WGXC. WGXC is nonpartisan and does not endorse or support political candidates. To participate in WGXC's on-air dialogue, call 518-622-2598 to either call in live to the studio or record a 3-minute message for broadcast expressing your point of view. Or send an email to info@wgxc.org.
WGXC underwriting is provided in part by The Highway Drive-In, a 4-screen drive-in movie theater in Coxsackie, New York. Information and schedule at hiwaydrivein.com.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Tail Campriel of Athens, New York. WGXC supporters care deeply about creative community radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Friday, April 25th. Local early morning temperatures range from 50 degrees in Steventown to 62 in Copake. Regional average soil temperature is 51 degrees. Time to plant that spinach, Swiss chard, okra, basil, and borage, whatever that is. Pollen levels are going to be near 100% today. It is going to be another warm one. A high of 77 will linger most of the afternoon. Cloud cover slowly grows until just before dark they bring some light rain. Overnight, that rain gets stronger and some bangs of thunder may be heard after midnight. Saturday, rain all day, thunder in the afternoon, a high of 72 at 2 p.m. Rain ends after midnight, we see a low of 42. And I know the camping bug has already crawled out in some of us, so be aware that getting wet in those temperatures can cause hypothermia. Sunday is looking gloomy. All day long, we get a chance for rain and some thick cloud cover. We get a high of 56 at 4 p.m. Monday is looking dry, sunny, with a high of 72. Sunset today will be at 7:32 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 5:56 a.m. Looking way up, we see X-class flare. Chances are at 1%. Plasma winds will be average at 477 kilometers per second with a thin density of 2 protons per cubic centimeter. Radio propagation conditions are currently solar max standard with an S1 level noise floor. There are no chances of aurora this evening. The current sunspot number is 152. And this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
The Public News Service Friday afternoon update, I'm Mike Clifford. The White House says it is closing in on general agreements with Japan and India to stave off massive U.S. tariffs, but they're likely to leave many of the thorny details to be hashed out at a later date. That from CNN. They report in the absence of full-fledged trade deals, administration officials are working to ink what three people close to the White House described as memorandums of understanding or broad architecture for future deals. They were granted anonymity to discuss the details of internal deliberations. It may take months to hammer out the final details, said one of the people, conceding these things are complicated. CNN notes it is the clearest sign yet of how President Trump and his top economic officials plan to tackle the gargantuan task they've bitten off, negotiating individual agreements with more than 60 trading partners. And next week, Congress is expected to vote on whether to roll back states' authority to set their own clean car and truck standards.
Data show some Nevadans could save more than $1,300 a year on fuel by switching to an electric vehicle. Rob Sargent is with the nonprofit Cultura, which advocates for a transition from gas-powered cars to EVs. He says the vote in Congress could potentially undermine EV availability, consumer savings, and subsequent job creation. Sargent says it's middle-class voters who benefit the most from driving EVs and using the federal tax credits to buy them.
their contractors driving 150 miles daily between job sites, rural drivers, tradespeople, and working families. Food over housing is more affordable, and jobs are further away.
Kultura has found people in northern Nevada who drive more than 25,000 miles a year spend on average close to $8,000 a year on gas. I'm Alex Gonzalez reporting.
Next, advocates for energy assistance programs warn that federal staffing cuts have vital staffing. We have reports from Maryland, and we begin with New Hampshire.
The Trump administration's layoffs of 10,000 health and human services workers include the entire office that oversees the low-income energy assistance program. Mark Wolf with the National Energy Assistance Directors Association says eligible households use the funds to avoid utility shutoffs.
Many states have told us that they're either run out of money or they're very close to it, and that they need this additional fund to help families pay off the remaining winter heating bill or get ready for summer cooling program.
I'm Catherine Carley.
Meantime, a report by the Maryland Office of the People's Council says energy rates in many parts of Maryland have far outpaced inflation. Maryland State Delegate Lori Sharkodian says cuts to LIHEAP would put further strain on people already trying to get by.
They have to choose between paying the rent and paying their heating bill. They have to choose between groceries and keeping the lights on.
A report by the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research found nearly 20% of Marylanders pay energy bills that are more than 6% of their income, which is considered high. This is Public News Service. More than 60 Pennsylvania counties don't have enough public defenders for the caseloads, forcing some, as in Erie County, to handle over 400 cases a year. Our Daniel Smith has more.
A report by Quattroni Center says the state needs more than 1,200 full-time public defenders, but has about 850. Sarah Jacobson with the Public Defenders Association of Pennsylvania says the state was one of only two that provided no funding for public defense, but $7.5 million was allocated in the last two state budgets. Jacobson says that has helped. Although spread across 67 counties, it isn't enough to make real change in places like Erie County.
Erie got in 23-24 a little over $102,000. The second appropriation, $106,723. The problem is that when you add the cost of an attorney's salary and benefits, the money that's there is not enough when it gets divided up.
The report finds Erie County would need 28 full-time attorneys to handle the large caseload to handle the growing need.
And the owner of Michigan's Palisades nuclear plant is getting another $47 million to restart the facility. It is the third installment of a $1.5 billion federal loan package.
Palisades was decommissioned in 2022 after more than 50 years of operation. Now owned by Holtec International, the plant in Van Buren County is expected to supply enough power to serve about 800,000 homes. But environmental and indigenous groups are voicing frustration after a federal panel recently denied a full hearing on petitions challenging the restart. Kevin Camps of the nonprofit Beyond Nuclear is among those in opposition.
A recent analysis by Dave Lockbaum, who is retired from the nuclear safety program at Union of Concerned Scientists, placed Palisades at something like 84th out of 105 reactors in the country. So his analysis was they're more like in the bottom rung of the industry, actually.
Crystal Blair reporting.
Finally, we head to Alaska, where the American Heart Association is helping save lives.
In a medical emergency, such as a heart attack, time and distance can be a formidable obstacle in rural Alaska for getting a patient to a hospital. The association says only about 10% of people who suffer a cardiac arrest outside of a hospital will survive, but access to CPR or a defibrillator can triple those odds. Kristen George with the Alaska Heart Association says it's all about keeping the blood flowing.
The benefit to having CPR and AED education is the time of restarting the heart. If we can keep the blood flowing to the heart, then we're not losing any of the parts we need. The reason we do the education is so that we continue to keep that heart beating.
George says by 2030, the association plans to visit more than 220 rural Alaskan villages.
I'm Mark Richardson.
This is Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Hello, good afternoon. You are listening to The Afternoon Show with Simone Stevens on WGXC, Acra 90.7 FM, radio for open ears. And before we start today, I have a little message from and for our community. The Coxsackie-Athens School District will be hosting a transition night for students with disabilities at Coxsackie-Athens High School on 4/30/25 from 6 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. We will have different community organizations set up in our high school cafeteria for students, parents, and educators to visit and receive information on transition services. So, all right, I am so excited today to have my guest, John Soul, founder and artistic director of Bridge Street Theater in Catskill.
Hello, hello.
Hi, John.
Hi.
So nice to have you here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, oh, my pleasure, our pleasure. I speak on behalf of the listeners and myself.
All right.
And the person walking by the studio right now, hello, them too. So I'd love to begin at the beginning, if that makes sense. you know, the theater began in 2013.
Right.
But your work in theater and directing and that drive for storytelling began much, much, much sooner than that.
Much sooner than that, yeah. I was actually born in Maryland, and then we moved to Kansas. But I grew up high school in Stillwater, Oklahoma, which is not quite a small town. It's the home of Oklahoma State University, you know, which has a pretty good football team. So sometimes.
That's no small thing.
Yeah. So I actually started doing theater in fifth grade. And I believe the first thing I ever did was a show in fifth grade. I played the secretary of a mad scientist in drag.
Wow, I love it. I'm picturing it right now.
And that was my start. Oh, it ruined my life forever.
In the best way, right?
Well, yeah, I suppose. You know, I continued to do theater in high school. I directed my first show. I was in a show called Wildcat Willie Carves the Turkey, which you can still get a copy of and do that, yeah.
Wow, where can we find
this? Oh, I don't know, Dramatists or one of those, you know, people. I just look that up, Wildcat Willie Carves the Turkey. It's a brilliant piece of theater. And then there was a summer theater that I took part in, and I played, I forget the name of the show, but I played, it took place in a small Midwestern town, and the hero had gone off to make it big in Hollywood. So he came back, and it turned out that the role he had was a off-screen barking dog.
Oh, the big dream. The dream role.
So that was another sign of my future, perhaps. Anyway, after that, I went to MIT in Boston and got a degree in mathematics. But while I was there, there's an extracurricular theater organization called Drama Shop. They had no classes in theater at all, but they had this very active drama shop. And they did two one-acts and one major production every semester. And the one-acts were directed by students, and then the head of the program, the extracurricular program, directed that. So I played, I was in, you know, Bartleby Fair by Ben Jonson. I was in Galileo, they did. So I did a lot of shows. And then in my junior year, the director of the program said, okay, it's time for you to direct.
Oh, wow.
And I said, oh, okay.
And
I went to the library and checked out all the books on directing. As a good MIT student did.
Yeah.
And I directed, my first play that I ever directed there was Aria da Capo by Edna St. Vincent Millay. I was handed a teaching assistant, who was given to me because in his classroom work, he was putting people to sleep. And they decided he needed to have some theater experience in order to energize his presentation.
I have a question. So there was no theater department at
MIT? No department, no.
So what was the goal on campus to have the drama shop for creative expression, for the sake of creative expression?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, I mean, it was a great program, actually. You know, there were two, you could get credit, there were two different classes. You know, one was working at, you know, backstage, and the other was just a history of theater class. And
just because it was important to being human. And
yes, back then, it was important. Then I also directed Tech Show, which was an all-student-written, student-produced, student-acted musical comedy. And that was my scene. I was in it my junior year in something called You Gotta Have Art. Mm-hmm. And then in my senior year, I directed it. It was called Tackled Pink.
Okay. With some detail. Give me at least one detail from that show.
Well, one detail was we had to cast somebody who was kind of an LBJ, you know.
Okay.
Character, mm-hmm. and he had to show his scar. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know whether you're young enough, old enough to remember that.
I'm one of those things.
Yeah. But Lyndon Johnson famously had an appendectomy, and to the press, he said, "Yeah, here's my scar," and he pulled up his shirt and showed his scar. Anyway, that was a bit in the show. But anyway, we needed this man. There were, you know, very few male actors, really, you know. And I didn't have anybody to play Lyndon Johnson. So I went out after our auditions, spotted this guy, you know, walking away from the theater, mm-hmm. went over to him and said, "Hey, you want to play Lyndon Johnson in our musical?" He said, "Sure."
Oh, so that's how easy. We cast him. That sounds so easy.
The other thing we did, there was a spy in it, you know, a Russian spy. And this woman was quite attractive, but me being kind of naive and weird, you know, had put her in some kind of a long dress. And my assistant director leaned over to me and said, "You've got to be kidding. Put her in short shorts."
Oh, my. Wow. You got schooled.
So we did that, and she was very successful. So the other thing about MIT doing theater was, of course, the set designs were all done by architect students.
Wow.
And the lighting design were all done by electrical engineers. Mm-hmm. So we had some incredible tech.
Yeah, but when you got out of MIT, did you rethink how you were going to spend your... or what you were going to do for your career afterwards?
Yeah, sure. I got my math degree, barely. Mm-hmm. I mean, I did okay, but then I went to...
For MIT, that means you did tremendously.
Well, whatever. I mean, I was from this little tiny town in Oklahoma, so given my, you know, naivete about the whole process, it was probably pretty... I did okay. Anyway, no, I went to graduate school at UC Berkeley in theater.
Wow.
So, you know, they said, "Oh, wow... we'll take an MIT guy who wants to do theater." So that was how I got started there. So I went on and got a PhD, actually, at UC Berkeley. So that was quite an experience. And I got a Fulbright Fellowship, actually, to study theater in South India.
Oh, my.
For my dissertation. So my dissertation is on a very obscure... form of dance theater that's originated in South India. So that was extremely interesting. I went there with my wife, mm-hmm. and a one-year-old daughter.
Oh,
and we spent a
wow.
year in India. So that was an amazing experience.
Did you bring any of that art form back? Were you driven to recreate it here?
Well, of course, I brought it back as a dissertation.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was something.
Yeah, but I mean,
Stage. You know, yeah. It's a beautiful form, but and I studied it. You know, I actually went to classes to study it. It wasn't just an academic exercise. It was actually a dramatic, you know, I became a very beginning actor of that particular form. It's called Kudiyattam.
Oh, wow.
In 1994, I believe, in San Francisco, I did a one-man show called Horripilation, which was based on my experiences in India. And it was interesting process to go back to that world and bring it on stage.
So. Was that your first time doing a one-man show?
Absolutely, and only. Although I did it several more times. Mm-hmm. No, my husband, Stephen, not husband then, but my partner, Stephen, at the time, had done a one-man show at the San Francisco Fringe Festival called Beauty, which we ended up taking it all over the world, actually.
Did
we
he took write it, to, it as well?
He wrote it. It's based on the work of Jean Genet. And it was a very, very out there, you know, nudity and sexual situations and all that. But very, very powerful and amazing reviews from that show. And he did that at the Fringe in San Francisco, and then we did it in L.A., and we did it in... we actually ended up taking it to the Gay Games in Amsterdam. Anyway, but he did a one-man show. I said, I'm going to do a one-man show.
But how helpful, right? You said, well, you've already gone through this process, so give me some pointers.
Oh, geez. It's a nightmare. You know, I mean, mine had way more words than his did, actually, because it was really a description of my experience. I mean, it started with the origin of theater in Hindu mythology and then went through. I started out, you know, in a loincloth, basically, and ended up in this incredibly elaborate costume.
Oh, wow.
I danced around the stage. So it was a very physical, very intense experience. I actually did it again at the Times Square International Theater Festival after we moved to New York.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
So that kind of made it around the world as well.
Well, yeah. Kind of. Yeah.
Both coasts, we'll say.
Yeah. So after college, I got a job working IT, actually, for an insurance company, and I continued to do that for 25 years. But I made money, and then I spent it doing theater. Stephen and I founded a company called Kali Yuga Arts, and we started doing theater in L.A. Originally, we did four shows in L.A., and then we moved to San Francisco, and we did 14, I think, shows in San Francisco. And then we did three shows in New York City when we moved there.
And this is actually where I have a question.
Okay, sure.
I want you I would love for you to expound a little bit on a particular word that I saw on your about section on your webpage, nomadic.
Okay.
Yeah. How was, like, because you sort of created, your productions were nomadic. So yeah. How did you decide that? Can you talk a little bit about that? When I see, like,
well, I mean, it wasn't quite nomadic. It was just, I mean, we say that just because we've been doing theater in a lot of different places.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the work that I had took me different places. So I started working in L.A. and then I got their home office. I worked for Fireman's Fund Insurance Company, actually, as an IT director for the staff council program there. So they moved me to Marin County, just north of San Francisco, which is where their home office was. So I worked there for quite a while. And then we moved to New York. We had a great apartment in San Francisco that got sold out from under us. So so I said, where are we going to move to? So I said, well, if I have twice as much money, we'll move to New York.
Yeah.
And then I said, we'll never have twice as much money. We're moving to New York anyway. So we ended up in New York, and we did three shows in New York. And then we because we had all this theater stuff, because we've been doing theater, we bought property in Catskill. So we bought 10 acres in Catskill that had a shed on it that we could store all the stuff that we had.
Yeah.
So we bought that, and then I designed and built a house on that property. So we have a house that I, you know, it was...
Did you call up some old MIT architect connections?
No, I didn't. You know, I had a dream when I was a kid of a hexagonal house in the woods.
Oh.
And it had, like, these arms going out around it, and... So when we were trying to think of a design for a house, I said, what about a hexagon?
So it was a premonition.
It's a dream. Literally a dream house. It was the affordable version of the dream.
That's the best kind.
Yeah, but it's the only way. Anyway, so yeah, I designed it, and then, you know, since I'm a set designer as well as a director, I wanted it to last longer than 6 weeks. So we had an architect come on board to do the designs, and an engineer to come on, make sure. And everybody went, "What is this house? It's so strange." To get it through the planning board.
Well, yeah, zoning. And like, I think about all those. I've known a few friends who have built homes, and it's not exactly a pleasant process.
Well no, and it was they're so complicated. They had no idea what to make of what we were building. Yeah. So, you know, we had to convince them that it was okay, you know, along the way.
I promise.
But anyway.
Shake on it.
Right,
I have a question, too, about when you were doing, you know, particular productions in different spaces.
Yeah.
Is there any process that you have to go through when you're doing, do you get attached to a production and then when it occurs in a new space or a different space, is there a way that you need to readjust or?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, sure. I mean, the very first show we did in L.A. was a musical called In Circles. Mm-hmm. It has a score by Al Carmines, who's a famous, he actually worked at Judson Church in New York City. But he loved Gertrude Stein. And so this is based on a text of Gertrude Stein called A Circular Play. Mm-hmm. And he wrote the music to it. Wonderful, just crazy score. I had actually done it. I was teaching for a while before I got the job, you know, in L.A. I was teaching at Dominican College in San Rafael. And we actually did that play at Dominican College first. Mm-hmm. And then I decided to start our, you know, production history in Los Angeles with that play. And then we did it again in New York City, in the place where it was originally done, Judson Church. And Judson Church hadn't done things there for ages, and we were the first ones to sort of bring productions back to Judson Church. Mm-hmm. So it's just a wonderful, lively, incredible piece of theater. So that was like so gratifying to take a play that we had done in L.A. and bring it back to where it was originally done back in the 60s.
Oh.
You know, and so this was in, you know, 2000. Something.
Yeah, because I also think, you know, different spaces have a different effect on us, right? So
right, and this is, you know, we had to actually completely build the theater space because it's in the assembly hall of the Judson Church, and so we had to bring in chairs. We had to, you know, make it. It was a circular,
sense
of in circles. We did it in the round. Yeah.
Wow.
And so it was a completely different space. So that was great. You know.
Wow.
So, yeah, so that was an example. The other one we did with that was a Beckett play called All That Fall, which is a radio play. And we did that in San Francisco. And then when we came to New York, I wanted to do a play that would be, you know, easy to put on its feet. And a radio play, you know, everybody has a script.
Yeah, they have a music stand.
We did. Yeah. And, I mean, actually, the Beckett estate insisted that you had to, the only action you could have is people walking from a seat to the microphone. But we got around that a little bit by having live sound effects.
Oh.
So we had Foley people, you know, walking on gravel and, you know, spraying water for rain, and you know, or yeah, you know, we had a thunder, you know, thunder thing, you know.
I've seen something recently that, and it was I was mesmerized. Being able, it's like almost like being able to see the mechanisms inside a clock move.
It's
a weird sensation. Yeah. It's
and it was so, and it's an incredible piece anyway. Mm-hmm. So we did that, and actually it was the 100th anniversary of Beckett's birth, the year that we did it. So I actually got my name in the New Yorker for directing this piece, and I said, okay, I've arrived.
I'm here, New York. If you can first make it here, you can make it anywhere.
First piece I did in New York.
So you said, if you can make it here.
That's right, yeah.
If you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. I'm heading upstate.
That's it. Yeah. So then we did three shows over at Stageworks in Hudson. Stageworks with a theater.
Is that where the Wick?
The Wick,
is
yes.
Now?
Yeah, it's been taken over by the Wick.
Because when I moved up here, they were having a closing out sale.
Yeah.
The theater was leaving. Remember, they were selling everything.
Right. Yeah, we bought a few things from them, actually.
Yeah. I got a pair of these amazing floral pants.
Okay.
That I just wore wore forever.
Yeah.
But so I remember the space, and I felt sad that I hadn't seen, you know, I missed that whole era.
Right. Yeah. Well, Laura Margolis ran that space for, I think, 12 or 13 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually, when I got up here, I was looking around for something to do, so I went over to Lorik, and we had seen a couple shows there and really liked what she had done. Mm-hmm. You know, they did interesting work. Mm-hmm. So I said, you need any help? And she said, well, I have this pile of scripts in the corner. If you want to read them, you can be our dramaturge. So I started reading them, and then she did, every year she did a series of one acts called Play by Play, and so I ended up directing with her.
So this was before
like
Bridge
years.
Street was even
this was
a,
before
a
Bridge
thought.
Street, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But we were still living, you know, we were living, building our house over here, and I was driving over to Hudson to do that. So, and then we did, after I did Play by Play, and she sort of shut down operation, I actually rented, we rented the space for three performances. So we did three shows there, as Cali Ugarts was the name of our production company.
Oh, wow.
So we did three shows over there. But we kept driving, you know, in on the way over there and to the gym, you know, the gym that used to be right down here.
Oh,
in
gosh,
the church.
I remember that.
I wish it were still there. That's so sad. Anyway, we kept going by this building on West Bridge Street. It had been on the market for like 3 or 4 years, I think. And every time we go by, we say, that, maybe that's our theater. So finally I said, let's just call a number.
The numbers, it's not sold yet. It's still
not
available.
Not sold yet. So we called the number. We walked around in it, and it was a mess. Mm-hmm. It was full of, you know, it was a book, a medical book depository most recently. So it was full of shelves and books and everything, and just, you know, it was truly a mess. Mm-hmm. But it looked like the space, it had all these different spaces. It looked like there was a space we could do a lobby. There was a big storage barn as part of it. And there was, you know, a big enough space to make a theater out of, a small theater out of.
Did you have a moment where you both looked at each other and went, yes.
Yes, well, we did, actually. And we, fortunately, when we ended up getting the building, some people told us, well, you do know Carol Allen, don't you? And I said, no. Apparently, very close to where we lived, our place was, there was this woman who was a retired theater design consultant. And she came on board. She did all the architectural drawings for the renovation for free.
How did you pull that off?
Right. Because she was just retiring, and she was just really, she loved theater, and she just wanted to help us out. So that was amazing.
Well,
amazing.
That's a wonderful time. That's right. That's when timing works out beautifully
yes, right.
for
yes,
everyone
absolutely,
involved.
Absolutely, yeah. So she did that. We submitted those plans to NISCA, the New York State Council of the Arts, and also Homes and Community Renewal, which had a big grant. Mm-hmm. They had a program called the Downtown Anchor Project, with which they would give money to one building that would become an anchor business for the neighborhood. And so we applied for that, and they gave us pretty good money to renovate the theater. So,
wow.
So anyway, that was a great boon. So that helped us. Mm-hmm. So we bought the building in 2013. And then 2014, we just started doing stuff wherever we could in the building. We did a Halloween, you know, walk through haunted house with the high school kids because it's right next to the high school, the theater building. Mm-hmm. So we've done a lot of work with the high school kids. So yeah, that was great. But then we, you know, finally got the whole, you know, theater set up. So it's a really jewel box kind of space now. It's really a beautiful little theater. It has a 4-bedroom apartment upstairs so we can house visiting actors.
Oh, that's so...
Which is great.
And it makes it an immersive experience for that visiting artist, too.
Absolutely. You know, that's how we survived COVID. Because COVID came, we couldn't do theater. Duke Dang, who runs the Works and Process program at the Guggenheim Museum, had all these dance companies in New York City who were desperate to do something because they had no place to go. They couldn't do anything in the city. Too expensive, too crazy. So he started setting up these residencies at different places. So we had, you know, so we had these dance groups come in. They would stay upstairs, you know, And they would come down, you know, walk down the stairs to get to the theater and work at the theater.
Wow.
So we had 12 different groups actually come in for like 1-2 week, residencies.
Wow, and in that time, have felt even more special.
It was totally special because they had nothing else. And they could call in food and, you know, it was completely quarantined.
They were like a bubble within a bubble.
It was totally a bubble, yeah. So, yeah, that was just amazing. So that was, and we loved that, you know.
Yeah.
We also spent the time, as Caligari Arts, we had all these videos that I'd never processed. So I spent a lot of time doing video editing and creating these archival videos.
So you stayed busy during that time.
I do, yeah. We stayed really busy. We have our 10 acres, in our house. So that was,
that's a lot of mowing, I hope.
most of it's just wild, Most of it's just new growth. Timber, but
I have a question about programming.
Sure.
When you first started and opened up the theater, you obviously had an idea of how you wanted to run the programming and what you wanted to do.
Yeah.
Has that changed, stayed the same, shifted?
Well, when we were Caliuga Arts, we would do one or two shows a year, just whatever we wanted to do. And we were in L.A. and San Francisco, which, doing crazy stuff was encouraged, let's say. So we were part of a program at the Exit Theater there. Mm-hmm. It was called the Absurdist Series. So we, that included Beckett or Gertrude Stein. We did Gertrude Stein stuff. We did a musical called Subject to Fits, which is based on Dostoevsky's The Idiot. So we did a lot of very out there kind of productions. When we came to up here, we realized, we probably have to pull back a little bit because, our audience is relatively conservative.
Mm-hmm.
But, we've been doing, we try to vary it a lot. So we do stuff that we really, want to do. And then we try to do at least one show a year that's kind of has name recognition. And,
have you ever been surprised by your
absolutely.
By your audience?
Oh, absolutely.
When you think
even
something?
This show we're doing right now, Polishing Shakespeare, is a show that's just full of words. I mean, it's just, very intellectual show, but we seem to be getting really good response. We did another show called There Is a Happiness That Mourning Is, which is a quote from William Blake. And it's a play with two teachers in it, that one teaches the songs of innocence and the other teaches the songs of experience. And they have had a long relationship, which they decided, because of the influence of Blake, they decided to consummate by going out in a lawn on the university and having sex in public.
Wow.
Well, the show takes place the morning after.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my.
And it's all written in rhymed couplets.
Mm.
And it's just like this very crazy piece. And we thought, I don't know, we may or may not get away with this.
Mm-hmm.
But, people seem to really love it. It's really, so that was great. That was a surprise.
Right.
So you really never know.
Yeah, we think we know what people will like, and then sometimes they surprise us, right?
Yeah. Well, on the other hand, we've also done The Glass Menagerie, which has gotten, which we've got great reviews for. We did Uncle Vanya. We did a Chekhov's Uncle Vanya last year that was very, very successful.
Mm-hmm.
And this year we're doing On Golden Pond at the end of the year.
I remember seeing the film.
Absolutely. Everybody has. Yeah.
What do you think are the two, on one hand having totally new works and more of a more experimental nature?
Yeah.
From voices you might not traditionally hear from, right? That seems to be important for your theater. And then on the other hand, we have the classics that sort of never lose their magic and maybe it's even new magic for new generations, right? So how do you have a feeling about how those two coexist?
Right, Well, we love doing new work, because then you're involved with the playwright and, things happen. We've done a lot of new work, even up here. And so that's been really satisfying to us. We've done, quite a few world premieres and regional premieres, too. One of the shows we're doing this year called Red Like Fruit is by a Canadian playwright named Hannah Moscovich.
Mm-hmm.
And we had done the U.S. premiere of a play called Sexual Misconduct of the Middle Classes a few years ago. And we tried to take that show to New York City, and we almost got away with it. There's a long story there. But
yeah.
Anyway, it's just about to open in the city with Hugh Jackman in the lead role.
Wow!
And what's her name? Ella. Sorry, I'll get it. She's another famous person.
I'll have to donate lots of blood to raise money for a ticket. That's
Ella Beatty. Who's Warren Beatty's daughter.
Oh, wow.
is playing the other one. It's a two-character play.
Do you feel like that's kind of a goal for theaters that are close to New York City, that eventually their work might get into the city?
Yes, we've never been successful in that. Unfortunately, we've tried it, I think, three times now, and it never quite has happened. We wanted to do one of the shows we did at Sageworks in Hudson was called Kill Me Now, played by another Canadian playwright named Brad Fraser, and it was a brilliant play and an incredible production. It kind of put us on the radar in the area because we had a lot of critics come to it, and it, you know, people were just bowled over by it. And we tried to take that to the city, but the agent, the problem here is that if you try to take something to the city, they will, because we would open it as a showcase, you know, or an off-Broadway production, you know, in maybe 1590s, 59th, which is a small off-Broadway theater. But the agents tend to think that if it's a world premiere here, then, well, we can take it to, you know, Playwrights Horizons or Lincoln Center. You know, we can make this a big splash. So we don't want your production to go there. So, you know, we just haven't ever been successful doing that. You know, I mean, we're not at the, you know, we're not Barrington Stage or, you know, that hires, you know, Broadway actors basically to do shows that then are for sure going, you know, to Broadway or off Broadway.
But I bet there must be a feeling when you see something and a wonderful piece of work come to life, knowing that it could exist.
Absolutely, yeah.
And you know, in a big city, because I see art up here, whether it's theater, music, or what have you, and I think, oh, I feel like I'm witnessing a secret, a wonderful secret.
Absolutely, you know, we have that. You know, I mean, people really feel that about us. You know, I mean, one of the decisions we made when we opened the theater here was to try to do as much work as possible that wasn't being done in the community theaters in the area. I mean, there's no other theater in Greene County. We're pretty much it. We've won the Best of Greene County Theater for every year since they started giving those awards, basically because there's no other theater.
You know, by process of elimination.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, the Orpheum Theater up in Tannersville is starting to come to life, and they're doing more stuff up there, so they may take over our award at some point.
Well, people come and say
we have, you know, this is so amazing, this is as good as anything we've seen in New York. And you know, it's really powerful theater, you're doing wonderful stuff. So it means we bring people. Most of our reviews come from the Berkshires. So we the critics come from you know, an hour away to come see our shows. So we just got, you know, for this show, we've got three different reviews from Berkshire organizations.
I have one here. May I share? Actually, before I share that, I'm going to share the quote, and then I'd love for you to talk about the production, because I know we have limited time on this production. So I have a wonderful review from Paula Kaplan Rice, Berkshire on Stage. The rhyme and rhythm of this play, along with the actor's incredible memorization and speed of delivery, reminds me of the delight of watching Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hamilton without the music. I think that's lovely. You know, and how does a wildly, this is from Patrick White, Metroland now, how does a wildly ambitious yet intimate theater company in the sleepy town of Catskill produce new, great, innovative plays using classic themes and characters while luring audiences away from their Netflix Oh, my gosh. And balance the books with small casts and design in-house. That's also, I mean, if you can lure people away from Netflix, you've really made it.
Right. Yeah.
So let's talk about this production, Polishing Shakespeare.
Yeah, we always have trouble with comedies because, you know, we don't like silly much, you know, so we try to do, if there are comedies, we want something that has some grit to it. So we actually, this play had been done at the Kitchen Theater in Ithaca earlier this year. They did a brief version of it at Edinburgh in Scotland for the Edinburgh Fringe. But we saw, we heard about the play, we read the script, we really liked it. And it's just, I mean, it's just, there's a lot of words. But it's so timely. I mean, it's about this basically dot-com billionaire who's given a lot of money to this theater to rewrite Shakespeare. And the idea is rewriting Shakespeare a cop-out? I mean, are you really selling out to do this? Because you're rewriting it so that, people will come because Shakespeare is just too boring and too long.
Right, make it digestible.
Absolutely, make it digestible. So that's what it's about, basically. And it goes, it has the head of a big regional theater who's getting this grant money and a new playwright who's come, who's been asked to write one of these versions. And she's very wary, let's say.
Grappling a little bit.
Does she do this or not, because the dot-com billionaire promises to pay off her debt, or pay off her college debt. So she goes, So anyway,
And you don't have to be a billionaire, which I don't think I personally know any, but you don't need to be a billionaire for that to resonate with you, right? Because everybody has their own threshold of what they feel they can sell it to.
Of course, it's so, funding for the arts is getting more and more complicated every day.
Oh, indeed.
I think when they did it in Ithaca, it was before the election. And they thought, okay, well, we're doing this, but it'll all be over shortly.
Right.
And now, of course, I think our approach to it is much more somber isn't the word. It's just much more, angry, I think, at what's going on. So it makes it... Again, it's just, you go, oh, my God, how did this happen? It's very prescient.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's the amazing thing about a production, too, when it plays at different times, right, different eras.
Yes.
Going to impact in a different way. There's going to be different reverberations.
Yeah.
For more information, everybody, by the way, you are listening to WGXC, Acre 90.7 FM, Radio for Open Ears with Simone Stevens, and talking to John Soule, founder and artistic director of Bridge Street Theater. And for more information on this season, we're going to get to the rest of the season as well. But for more information about tickets, you can go to www.bridgestreet.org.
BridgeST.org. Right.
Yes. Yeah. So what's up next? What's up next?
Well, the next thing we're doing is a play called Mary Jane by Amy Herzog, and that's in end of May, May 22nd through June 1st. This was a play that played off-Broadway like 4 years ago, and we read it and loved it and asked for the rights. We couldn't get the rights. Mm-hmm. We asked the next year for the rights. We couldn't get the rights. Mm-hmm. We asked the next year for the rights and finally said, what the hell is going on?
Yeah.
And it turns out that it was optioned for Broadway. So last year it was done on Broadway. So as soon as that production closed, we again asked for the rights and we got them.
Oh,
so,
wow.
So what, finally,
what
we
a
have
journey.
It. This is very different from Polishing Shakespeare. It's all women, for one thing, and a woman director. It's five women. Amy Crossman actually is playing the lead role. Mary Jane is a woman that had done a solo show for us, is a wonderful actress. It's about a woman who's dealing with a severely disabled 2-year-old child, and there are four other actors who play people that are part of her life in trying to deal with this. So it's an incredible play about. Well, I'll read. Yes, it's the challenges and the difficulties in dealing with this situation. Mm-hmm. Yet the love and the tenderness and the care, that comes out of it. So mm-hmm. it's a very deep, very moving piece. We didn't like the Broadway production much because it's really not a Broadway play. Mm. It's a very intimate play. Mm-hmm. We have a very intimate space. You know, mm-hmm. we have 84 seats,
wow.
Beautiful proscenium space. Mm-hmm. And so I think we can do, and we have a wonderful cast.
Yeah.
So I think we can do really, make it very, very intense and moving for people. So,
it also seems timely to me as well.
Absolutely,
I think, in times of great anxiety and stress, which a lot of people are feeling, it's really hard to feel like one has the emotional capacity or space to be a caretaker.
Absolutely,
to those in their life, and that can be another stressor. But to sort of find the beauty and love that exists in caretaking.
Absolutely, and it's really, it's a really beautiful play. So that's nice. And then we're doing a musical in mm-hmm. the summer. It's called South. It's an original musical. It'll be a world premiere.
And that's by somebody who...
Yes,
local,
Carmen right? Borgia is a guy who has been doing our set design for shows and has written this musical, which actually got some awards on an online audio site. I unfortunately don't remember.
Did
the
you
name,
know
but, yeah.
that Carmen was?
Oh yeah,
a
we had actually done a reading of this play a few years ago, mm-hmm. And so we decided that if we're going to do it, so it's just this crazy wild play about pirates and.
and you have a built-in set designer.
And we have a built-in set designer. Yes, right. Yeah. So that'll be great fun. Very different. It says it's like filled with pirates, cannibals, nuns, and drunken town folks. And,
oh, wow. Yeah. That's a ride.
So that's a very different show. So, we try to shake it up. There's very, very different. And then we're doing this other Hannah Moscovich play, the one who wrote Sexual Misconduct mm-hmm. of the Middle Class. It's a new play. Again, I think it'll be the U.S. premiere of this play.
Oh, wow.
It's called Red Like Fruit. It's a two-character play, very unusual, mm-hmm. About domestic abuse. Mm-hmm. And so, again, very feminine, very... very moving.
And intimate play. As well, yeah.
And very intimate, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then we're doing On Golden Pond at the end of it.
That's a great way to wrap up the season.
Absolutely. Well, we figure people know that play, and are going, oh, well, I'll go to see that. And then, I'll endure the other stuff.
We'll wrap the year up with some nice sweetness, some nostalgic sweetness.
Although,
right?
It's a really well-written play, and it's really quite, there's a lot of tension involved mm-hmm. in the family dynamics there. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the lead character is, like, fading into dementia. Mm-hmm. So there's some real stuff going on in it. It's not just, yada, yada.
Yeah. It's meat and potatoes.
It is meat and potatoes.
I relate to you as well as not – I'm not a huge fan. There's some – shows that are on, and my mom will say, oh, don't you watch that show? I love it. It's so funny. I said, it's funny, but it doesn't have any meat and potatoes. I can't take just funny.
There has to be
some thread that is
absolutely.
Touching on something that matters or something serious.
You're our audience.
Yes, I think I am your. Well, I have tickets to the show on Sunday.
Okay,
so.
Great. Yeah, that's going to be great.
I will be
there. Yes.
You'll see. Yes. So, we're kind of getting to the end of the hour here. It's flown by, and it's been such a pleasure having you. What would you say is, what's your vision for the theater in, let's say, 2 years?
Well, I'm 80 this year. Uh-huh. And I told our board of directors, I said, I'm trying to back away here. What can you do for us? Uh-huh. So we're looking at, some potential. We brought on a new executive director mm-hmm. named Allison Davey, who actually is the wife of Carmen Borgia.
Mm-hmm.
So
oh.
it's still a family affair.
Yeah.
Stephen, my husband, is also involved, all the time in the process. Mm-hmm. But we're trying to pull back. So we actually have, we put out the word for a new artistic director, applications. We got like 35 applications in, I think.
Oh, yeah. I think you have a lot of, I was almost going to say expats, but ex-city dweller, should I say?
Yeah. Well, you know, the COVID brought a lot of people up here.
It sure did.
And so we're finding we have a lot more talent, local talent, theatrical talent than we used to.
Now, do you think that creates a little tension sometimes?
Not for us. It just gives us more opportunity.
More talent to choose from.
Yeah. And there are, actually, in the capital region as a whole, the theater situation is changing a lot. I mean, there's a lot of new theaters happening in the capital region. I just went up to the Theater Barn in Albany on Wednesday, and that was a celebration of the 400th anniversary of 400 something. It was anyway Shakespeare's birthday, and there was a big crowd there. And Patrick White, who wrote one of those reviews, is a real champion of Capital Region Theater, and he created this event, and it was a big crowd, and there are just lots and lots of theater happening in the Capital Region. So most of it is non-professional, very few professional theaters. We are kind of a semi-professional theater. We hire equity actors, but we are not officially an equity theater, the union.
Well, that can present challenges, though, being an official. You have some more restrictions, maybe?
Yes, many, many more, and it's much more expensive.
Which is challenging for us.
But we have the charge and the obligation, we feel, to pay everybody who works at our theater. So, and our non-equity actors make the same salary as our equity actors. So we do pay everybody that works there something, at least. It's a semi-professional theater officially, but
Anything to keep the engine running, right?
Yes. We want to pay people. I mean, I think it's important to, there's so many theaters that just expect everyone to work for free because it's art, and that has limited, you're very limited in what you can do
I think
in that situation.
That's also call it somewhat of an epidemic that has reached into all kinds of art, this expectation that it should be free. I've experienced that as a musician with,
absolutely.
Where the valuation has sort of been removed in some sense. Yeah.
I mean, we don't pay a huge amount of money, but it's what equity, requires us to pay. And
well, I'll say it's the thought that counts.
Well, no, it's the money that's important. I mean, more than thought, we do come through.
We want both. Yeah, we want the thought and put thought into action.
Exactly.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I wanted to also ask: could you name like one event or moment when you realized how important and we're getting down to the minute here, how important storytelling is for you?
Okay,
was that a certain production? Was it a singular moment?
I don't know. Not a question I can answer. I don't think. No, I mean, theater is storytelling, so it's very important to, as a director, you want to make clear what the story is and bring that forward to make sure that people know what's going on. So, it's a very important part of the process of directing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Well, it's been such a pleasure having you on. Well, is there anything else? We're getting down to the countdown, and I hate to lose you.
It happens.
Yeah, anything else?
Anyway, yes.
Yeah, you share with us. Any last things that you want the community to hear about your theater?
Well, we'd love for you to support our activity. I think it's a very important resource for the village and the county and the whole region, actually. Mm-hmm. So, it's a great, it's wonderful to have been able to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully we can keep it going.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I know that I'm going to be there.
Yes, thank you. That's great.
I'm a part of keeping it going.
Yes, absolutely.
So you have been listening to WGXC Acra 90.7 FM radio for open ears, and I have been talking with John Soule from Bridge Street Theater in Catskill, New York. It has been such a pleasure being with you, listeners.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, today, and with you, John. We only have like a minute left, so okay. I am going to play a little bit of the story by Brandy. She will be interrupted by the news. I apologize, but here we are.
Okay.
All of these lines across my face tell you the story of who I am. So many stories.